UK.
Everybody, I am Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm joined, as ever and always, by producer extraordinaire Anya Esther. Welcome all, 844-967-2789. It has been, we've had a lot of guests recently. It's been a lot of fun. I hope everybody's enjoying learning alongside of me and with me. Today, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court's shadow docket, but tomorrow, going to be joined by my good friend Colleen Foley, the executive director of the Legal Aid Society. Terry Barr will be on with us on Thursday talking about what's local and overlooked in the news of Wisconsin. On Monday, I'm going to be joined by Milwaukee County Circuit Court candidate Rochelle Johnson-Bent. On Wednesday, December 13th, so that's next Wednesday, I'm going to be joined by Molly Dubin, who is the curator at the Milwaukee Jewish Museum, talking about a really great exhibit they've got going on through the end of the year called Women Pulling at the Strings of Social Discourse. Really excited to have Molly on. And I am working on having the executive director of the Ability Center, who just opened a universally accessible huge park not far from Milwaukee County Zoo that we talked about on Giving Tuesday last week. So much cool stuff coming up. And of course, my great thanks to Professor Catherine Eden, who joined us yesterday from Princeton, talking about poverty in the United States and how universal voucher systems lead to segregated school systems, because that's exactly what they're designed to do. Let's just a little prequel, like, why is it really important to talk about the Supreme Court's shadow docket? Let's just take a few tidbits from the last two business days of news, shall we? On Friday, two separate courts ruled that no, President Trump does not enjoy the divine right of kings and can, in fact, be held civilly and criminally liable. Big news, two different courts, federal court, state court, it matters. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard arguments in the opioid bankruptcy case about whether or not third parties can effectively be discharged of potential future liability in a bankruptcy that does not directly include those parties. We're talking about the Sackler family, the century's biggest criminals who will never spend a day behind bars. Bigger, I would argue, with more disastrous effect than those crooked bankers that helped foster and profited off of the 2008 financial crisis. Bigger criminals than that, with a more dire and long-term economic and cost, just costing lives, right? Never going to see a day in prison. That was being argued yesterday before the Supreme Court. On Friday, the Supreme Court is going to convene to start discussing three certiorari opinions. I'm going to explain what certiorari is today and what's happening that's not within the certiorari system. Certiorari, you're like, what the hell does that word, Latin weird word mean? It basically is simply, do we, the highest court, decide to hear a case? And that mechanism that where you ask the Supreme Court to hear a case is called a certiorari request. They're three hearing, it's actually five total cases on two critical issues on Friday, all surrounding whether or not women enjoy the same right to choose and select healthcare that men do in this country. They're hearing three cases on mifepristone and whether or not that frequently used drug should continue to be available to women, or whether, you know, willy-nilly judges get to substitute their non-expertise for the FDA's expertise without much of an explanation at all whatsoever. And they're hearing two cases that involved whether EMTALA actually requires that abortion care be provided under certain circumstances. EMTALA is a federal law that basically requires hospitals to provide, quote, stabilizing treatment, end quote, when someone in a life-threatening condition appears in their emergency room. That obviously sometimes includes abortion. And in certain states, the federal law requiring that stabilizing treatment to be provided simply cannot be squared with state bans on abortion. Also happening in court, again, this is just news over the last 2 days. Indeed, the third branch of government matters quite a bit. Donald Trump filed a raft of discovery cases in his criminal Jan 6 case that's proceeding in the DC circuit. They're nuts, okay? And his discovery requests make very, very, very plain that the core of his defense of the in the January 6th criminal case that's going to proceed in the DC circuit before Judge Chutkan is going to be, no, the election was actually stolen, and actually it was liberals and or federal law enforcement that did the January 6th thing. It wasn't Trump supporters. That's going to be what he's arguing. Here is a flavor of some of the discovery requests. Whole bunch of stuff about Antifa. Like, oh, no. It wasn't the people in the MAGA hats and the Proud Boys and the 3%ers. And no. It wasn't Trump-aligned people. Nobody was actually heeding his call to overthrow the government. No. It was Antifa. And if it wasn't Antifa, next set of discovery requests basically are pursuing conspiracy theories propagated by OAN News, Newsmax, and all the right-wing nut job spin machines out there, that it was actually the FBI that staged and then did January 6th. I mean, that's the argument. That one's the guy that gets cited all the time as a dude by the name of Ray Epps. Interesting, the devils were just talking about John Nichols a moment ago. That is part of the next set of bananas discovery requests. John Nichols was somehow commanding this, and it's targeting him. It's the right-wing media machine. He's a reporter from Madison, liberal guy, had nothing to do with it. Discovery requests about the scaffold commander. Again, this is all trying to lay the foundation that it wasn't actually Trump supporters doing January 6th. This was all, again, a big federal governmental conspiracy or a libs conspiracy or Antifa. Another conspiracy theory that they submitted a bunch of discovery requests is this, quote, fence cutter bulwark. I mean, I don't even know what does that mean? I don't know. I had to go look it up. Apparently they're claiming that someone cut and removed snow fencing, which is that like plastic stuff, you know, so as to welcome the January 6th rioters and insurrectionists. Like, let me see here. Last time I checked the law on criminal trespass, it doesn't really matter if the door's open, if it's still not your property and you're not supposed to be there. So, but I digress. And there's a bunch of discovery requests that basically are aimed and rhetorically presume that the 2020 election was stolen. So yeah, that's how Donald Trump's going to defend January 6th. All of that news, all of it, that's all about the law. Half the Georgia defendants, lawyers. And again, so much of what happens here is shrouded in this legal, easy, technocratic speak that makes it hard for us regular people to understand and get a grip. Like, wait a minute, what's actually happening? Obviously, I endeavor whenever we get together here on the radio waves to break that stuff down so we actually can have an understanding together of what's happening. If you want to join me this afternoon, if you need something decoded, you want to weigh in on the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, whatever it is, 844-967-2789. But of all of the masking of what's really happening in our legal system and how rich people and powerful people are able to influence and twist the legal system to serve their purposes, that while we may be at least on the surface equal under the law. The law does not result in equal treatment. It benefits people like Donald Trump. Powerful, rich, white, male, landowning. Christian nationalists. Okay. The most pernicious iteration of what is happening within our legal system is the Supreme Court's shadow docket. I always want to give credit where credit is due. Much of the discussion today and tomorrow about this topic is based on and drawing from the work of Professor Steve Vladek, who is a leading scholar of the American court system and the Supreme Court. He's a professor at the University of Texas. He just wrote a book called The Shadow Docket, How the Supreme Court Uses Stealth Rulings to Amass Power and Undermine the Republic. I've reached out to Professor Vladek. I sure hope he answers my email after the exam season is done, because we'll have him on. I'm also very happy to say that Professor Eden's agreed to join us again here on the Maggie Don Show. I'll have her back in the new year. We cannot understand what the Supreme Court and its shadow docket is today unless we begin at the very beginning. And so what I'm going to talk about today and tomorrow is how the Supreme Court's power has changed over time. Because it is only when we understand that in its context that we can start to see, first, it hasn't always been this way, which means it doesn't have to stay this way. And secondly, that no matter what party you may subscribe to, which way you butter your bread, that a court that can fundamentally alter any of our rights without explanation, without saying who voted for what, without any briefing, without any argument, that they can fundamentally, in the middle of the night, alter fundamental rights that every single one of us rely on, that sort of unchecked power is not democratic. Those are the two purposes that we are going to engage this discussion. Understanding again, it hasn't always been this way. It don't have to be that way today. And they are doing this without accountability. I'm Maggie Don. You're listening to the Maggie Don Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Getting smarter together. Join us, 844-967-2789. Everybody, I'm Maggie Don. She is Anya Esther. You are listening to the Maggie Don Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join us, call or text 844-967-2789. Drop a comment if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook or the Twit or X or whatever it's called. And we will get to it. Today I'm going to go into the history of the Supreme Court's merits docket and shadow docket so that we can understand that where we find ourselves today with the court, what seems like almost on a monthly basis, issuing some bombshell decision in the middle of the night that really changes how and what our rights are, and how we get to live our lives. But it hasn't always been that way. Let's take an example that many of us may be vaguely familiar with, okay? On July 13th, 2020, the Supreme Court issued a decision that it was requested to make on an emergency basis. More on that in a moment. And in this case, there is a guy named Daniel Lewis Lee, who had been awaiting execution. And his crimes were terrible. He was convicted in 1999 of murdering a family of three. But there were some questions about whether or not his constitutional rights had been observed and respected throughout his process. Now, regardless of someone's crimes in a democracy, when the government decides to kill someone as punishment, you had better have done that correctly, right? That's the whole point of these appeals. And so a federal appeals judge had intervened the first, like right around his time of execution, and said, no, this execution is going to, needs to be stayed. Stayed means you can't do that quite yet until we have a full hearing of his constitutional claims. Well, the state that wanted to execute Mr. Lee filed an emergency petition to the Supreme Court to lift the stay. And a lot of this, the arguments in Mr. Lee's case have to deal with the use of phenobarbital, which hasn't effectively killed people. Doctors won't do it, so it's not even MDs administering it. They're running out of phenobarbital because pharmaceutical companies don't want to provide it because it's being used to kill people. It's messy business. There's a guy, I forget what his name is. They tried to kill him three times with it and it didn't work. It causes incredible pain and suffering. And the Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. By the way, the state's argument, like, actually, you don't need to worry about that. The phenobarbital will be fine. The state argued this in their brief. The Eighth Amendment does not guarantee a painless death. It only guarantees that you cannot super add. They use the word super addition. I didn't know that was a word. The Eighth Amendment only prohibits the super addition of terror, extreme pain, and disgrace. Ugh. Lawyers, people, I tell you. Well, in the middle of the night at 2 a.m., the Supreme Court issued its decision on this emergency request by the state to lift the stay so that they could execute Mr. Lewis. And the Supreme Court said, stay lifted, go ahead and kill him. And so they did. It was the first federal execution. So this was a federal crime. He's a federal prisoner. So it's the first federal execution that occurred in 17 years. And it happened in the middle of the night. Now, most of us know, oh, the Supreme Court drops these like 80-page, 100-page, 200-page rulings of all of this detailed analysis, and you've got the dissents and the concurrences, and it's all laid out in detail. Well, guess what? Despite the fact that lower courts found that Mr. Lewis's constitutional rights had been violated or were at risk, despite that lower federal courts had found that and had stayed his execution so that there could be a full set of arguments and briefing about these issues, the Supreme Court, without a word of explanation, no decision issued other than the order, go ahead and kill him. That, my friends, is the shadow docket. These are decisions about matters of life and death, no less, that are made oftentimes in the middle of the night. There's no written decision. It's simply an order most often. With the vote totals, you don't even know which justices voted for what. It'll just 5-4, 6-3. You would think maybe, even if the vote is 5-4, yeah, go ahead and kill him. Maybe that shouldn't be the case. Because four Supreme Court justices are saying, let's fully hear the arguments. Let's actually write a decision that people can look at. Let's be accountable to what our conclusions are. But no, an emergency request made by the state that effectively says, we will be harmed. We, the state, will be harmed if we can't kill this person immediately. That's some scary business. But the shadow docket and how the court hears these emergency cases, these emergency requests for stays, isn't only in the area of executions and criminal law. It has exploded into virtually all other areas of rights and the liberties that all of us, no matter what our party, our race, our gender, etc., can be impacted by. Happening in the dark of night without explanation, without attribution, with no arguments, no oral arguments, no briefing by the parties to the Supreme Court. Just the request to either grant or lift these emergency stays. Now, just looking at July of 2020 alone, there were decisions on emergency stays dropping at 2:10 in the morning, 2:10 a.m., 2:26 a.m., 3 a.m., also that month, not just the death penalty cases, and there were a bunch in July of 2020. Also that month, other emergency decisions that took immediate effect that were issued in the middle of the night involved voting procedures because of what was happening then? You know, COVID. Trump's tax returns, emergency decision, no attribution, no written decision. July 2020 alone. Now, if you're listening and you're saying to the radio, now, wait a minute, Maggie, shouldn't it be the case that indeed there are some situations where the Supreme Court may need to act that fast, where they don't have time to write up these detailed decisions? Yep. And we're going to talk about that because the Supreme Court has had the power to act in emergency situations for over 100 years. But the way that the court is using that power now has never happened before in the entire history of the Supreme Court. You're not going to want to miss this breakdown, everybody. So keep it locked in. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Your views, opinions, questions, decoding of legal mumbo jumbo, always welcome. 844-967-2789.
And I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping, with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and
we're doing the work this afternoon here on the Maggie Dawn Show. With me is Anya Esther in the production booth. We are talking about the out-of-control Supreme Court of the United States. And don't worry if you happen to be more conservative and you're thinking, I love these decisions. They're great, like you're Tony the Tiger. This is just a point in time. And unless we do something about a Supreme Court that basically wields power without any accountability, they will come for the things that you care about too. It ain't about Dems and Republicans. This is about a fundamental balance of powers, and we are imbalanced right now. So let's return. I described what many of us may sort of understand, or at least have some vague awareness, that there are emergency requests that go to the Supreme Court of the United States without full briefing, without any oral argument to the court, to stop executions. That's usually what we think of. By the way, if you want a great movie about the death penalty, go watch The Life of David Gale. It's incredible. Now, Kevin Spacey is a dirtbag, but the movie is fantastic. Also, of course, Dead Man Walking with Susan Sarandon. Also said some complicated... She's maybe a little bit of a dirtbag too. You know, it's Hollywood, folks. But... That's not how, it's not just in the death penalty space anymore that the Supreme Court's using this emergency power to impact all of our rights. So where did we begin? Well, for the first 101 years that the Supreme Court existed, it was basically led around by the nose by Congress. Congress controlled the Supreme Court. It told the Supreme Court what cases it could hear, what cases it couldn't hear. Now, I just want you to think about that for a second. Congress, for the first 100 years of the Supreme Court, led the Supreme Court around by the nose. Oh, ye, how times have changed. They can't even get a Supreme Court justice to show up to explain their lack of ethics rules when Congress asks them to. So ain't Congress leading the Supreme Court around by the nose anymore. It's the other way around. How dare you ask me about my ethics? Don't you know I'm a Supreme Court justice beyond reproach? I mean, that's effectively Alito's response, right? Here is an example of that. In Congress, in 1802, Congress just canceled the entire session of the Supreme Court. They're just like, you're done for this year. Nope, thank you. No Supreme Court in 1802. Because there was a fight between the Jeffersonians and the Federalists. They just went, we don't want you to decide any of this. We'll hash it out in the legislature. Thank you. Here's another example. After the Civil War, the federal government divided the nation up into basically 5 military districts in the South, in the Confederacy. Okay. So the South lost the war post-Civil War. Federal government says, well, the former Confederate states, we're going to create 5 military districts. There's going to be basically martial law. Because you had people that were fighting to destroy the country, right? Well, a Mississippi newspaper editor thought that was bunk and sued. So this is a violation of our constitutional rights. And challenged the legality of these military districts that were set up to govern the former Confederate states. Well, Congress looked at that and went, we're not really sure what the Supreme Court's going to do with that case. So, yes, Supreme Court, we just removed your jurisdiction over the matter. They didn't know how the justices would shake out on the Mississippi newspaper editor's challenge to the military districts that the federal government had set up to help basically bring the former Confederacy to heel. Congress just took away the Supreme Court's ability to hear that case. Poof! So that is just very, very unlike what we're seeing today by any measure. So how did we get to this expanded level of Supreme Court power? Well, it began and is largely traceable to William Howard Taft. Now, many people remember there's President Taft. But William Howard Taft's real love, his obsession, if you will, his lifelong obsession, was the Supreme Court. He was a lawyer. He only sat for 4 years. He was the president after Teddy Roosevelt. And then he became a Supreme Court justice. And Taft's conception of the Supreme Court was that it should be very powerful, that it should decide the cases that it hears. Because the Supreme Court, with Congress telling it what it was going to hear and what it couldn't hear, had led to just an incredibly huge caseload for the Supreme Court. They couldn't keep up. By the late 1800s, this was right before Taft became president, the Supreme Court docket had over 1,800 cases. They couldn't get ahead of it. There's just not enough capacity. So Taft took that opportunity saying, listen, the Supreme Court is overwhelmed. We need to reform the court to allow it to control the cases that it hears, to decide what they decide and how they decide it. And so Congress gives to the Supreme Court in the early 20th century, in the early 1900s, the power to create the certiorari system, right? Again, cert. Please hear my case, dear Supreme Court. I don't like what the appeals court did. And the Supreme Court then will issue basically short decisions, but decisions nonetheless that say yes, no about what cases they're taking. Interestingly enough, Congress provides no rules to the Supreme Court to govern which cases they're going to take. Taft didn't want that, in large part. And this is the first time in the Supreme Court's history where it can start to do things without really explaining. Now, it's the current convention that oftentimes some decision is written about why cert is granted, but it's not required. They can simply grant cert or not grant cert, no explanation necessary. It is a black box. And as you move through the 19th century, right, what happens? The Depression, and you have the great expansion of the federal government as impacting regular Americans' day-to-day life. Because of the New Deal, right? We set up a Department of Education, a Department of Agriculture. There's a welfare system. So there's a great expansion of the federal government. Federal government got way bigger. There was a national currency. That was all in the 19th century. You didn't always have that. Federal Railroad. So your courts, again, get very, very, very busy. And so even, you know, you got cert, but they're still very busy. There's all this new federal law, all this new federal government. It's impacting regular people's lives. So again, the question comes to Congress, what do we do about this? There's too many cases, not enough time. You either put more judges on the court, right? You just more people to decide more cases. Or you give the Supreme Court more power. Well, Congress, again, this is when they give Congress the cert power. They also created many, many, many more lower court judges. So they did both. They both increased the number of judges and gave the Supreme Court power over which cases the court will decide. So this is this period now, basically between 1925 and 1988. And the Supreme Court newly has discretion. There were still some cases that the Supreme Court had to decide, the mandatory cases. And many people cite to this period in the court, especially as you approach the 50s and 60s, as a progressive period of the court, right? This is civil rights litigation. Interestingly enough, here's what, and Professor Vladek makes this point really eloquently in his book. He says, Congress wasn't so dysfunctional then as it is now. And so while the court were pushing the civil rights movement forward, it was trying to preserve rights to actually help bring the promise of the Reconstruction era, which is when Black folks really, before Jim Crow, built up political power and economic power, all then to be stripped away during the Jim Crow era. But Professor Vladek makes the point that Congress was not so dysfunctional as it is now. And if the Supreme Court was pushing rights forward, in other words, moving us down this progressive equalization and equity objective during that period of time, 40s, 50s, 60s, Congress would have pushed back. Congress was not so, again, dysfunctional, unable to legislate as what we find now. And you can contrast what the court was doing in the 40s, 50s, and 60s to what happened in the 30s, which is where you had a very, very conservative Supreme Court that was pushing back on the New Deal policies that came out of the Depression. Oh, this is an overreach. No, the federal government can't do that. And does everybody remember vaguely somewhere in your memories of high school the court packing scandal? Like, oh my gosh, they're going to pack the court. Right? This was FDR was, well, you guys are going to undo all these New Deal policies that are supposed to actually protect most Americans to help revive our economy after the Great Depression, regulate capitalism in some meaningful way. FDR threatened to pack the court, and there was incredible political pressure that was put on the court by Congress and the president. Now, he didn't end up, the court packing was unsuccessful, but the court effectively relented. It stepped back from that. And then you see the rise of the progressive Supreme Court that leads us through the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So if you take what was happening then, again, 40s, 50s, and 60s, if Congress didn't like it, if the court would have been too far ahead of the general public, Congress would have stepped in to rein the court in. Contrast that with today. The court doesn't care at all what public opinion is. They're issuing all manner of decisions that the vast majority of Americans disagree with. And they sure as heck do not fear Congress. I mean, have you seen what's going on in the House of Representatives? I wouldn't be afraid of that. They can't even pick a speaker. So before we get to 1988, the court was still hearing emergency cases, but in no way, shape, or form like they are doing today. And it's fascinating to me because the change that happened in 1988, there was no law that was passed. There was no different regulation of the Supreme Court. They just decided to start doing stuff differently. So when I come back, I'm going to set the table for that. If you've got questions or comments, 844-967-2789. Tomorrow, we will deliver the epic punchline and some of the most shocking statistics I've ever read about the Supreme Court. So keep it locked, everybody. You got one more segment today to lay a bit more groundwork. You're going to be really surprised about what I have to say. Most lawyers I know don't even know this stuff. So keep it locked. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
I got my sights set on you, and I'm ready to wait. I have a heart that will never be tamed.
I've got my sights set on you, Supreme Court, and a heart that will never be tamed when you are screwing it up so epically. Breaking it down here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Thanks for listening, everybody. Join us for the last segment, 844-967-2781. So before we got to break, I told you, listen, in 1988, without a change in law, without nothing formal, the Supreme Court just started to do things differently when it comes to emergency requests, which may beg the question in your mind, okay, so I understand the certiorari, where there's time, right? It's just a case that's proceeding normally, and then they don't like the appeals court decision. There's no time exigency, so there's a cert request that goes to the Supreme Court. Again, that power was not always the Supreme Court's. Prior to Taft, didn't exist. He set the stage for all of that. And it has always been the case that the Supreme Court has to deal with things that are indeed emergencies. We don't have time to have full oral arguments and full briefing and sit down and write a super detailed multiple, you know, tens and tens of pages of decision. So the way that the court before 1988 used to handle emergencies, not cert, that's separate. That's when we don't have an emergency, but the emergency system was that you got 9 justices on the court. By the way, the size of the court hasn't changed since like 1887 or something. It's 9 people, a lot more folks in the country, a lot more laws, but just 9 people. They basically, when it came to emergencies, just divided the country up into 9 different geographic sections, and each one of the 9 justices was responsible for deciding emergency requests that came out of their assigned geographic district. You dig? Right? Probably one of the most famous instances of this was a guy by the name of James Meredith, who in 1961 applied to go to the University of Mississippi. He was Black. Anybody want to hazard a guess about what the University of Mississippi did with his application to attend there? Yeah, Ole Miss said no. And so he sued. And eventually there was an emergency application that was assigned to Judge Hugo Black, whose district included Mississippi, because it was like, I've applied. Do I get in? Because I'd like to start school. That was an emergency. And Judge Hugo Black decided, yeah, you're going to let Mr. Meredith attend. And by the way, he did graduate from Ole Miss. White people rioted when he tried to actually go to school. Two people died. Hundreds were injured. But he went to Ole Miss. And this system had some advantages, right? Much easier to get one person to decide something than nine. You could actually get a justice on the phone. Sometimes they even had like little quasi-abbreviated arguments. Get in my chambers. Let's talk about the case. Tell me what you think, one side. The other side, tell me what you think. There was some process. There was some deliberation. Sometimes the justices would actually issue a shorter written opinion themselves about why they granted or denied the request for emergency relief. And no one ever thought, like, this one justice speaks for the full court. And any single one of those emergency requests eventually ended up in a full case before the court, in most cases. So everyone understood these were temporary decisions. This wasn't the full court. This wasn't indicative of what might happen before the full court. And I'm going to hold it right there. And just tease for you where we're going to begin tomorrow. And then I'm going to take a couple callers. You want to get it in here before the end of the show. 844-967-2789. This all began to change when the Supreme Court, after placing a moratorium on the federal death penalty in 1972, in 1976 decided, oops, we got that one wrong. Yep, federal government can kill people, and re-upped the death penalty. That's where our story we'll pick up tomorrow. You're going to want to hear this, folks, because there are things that I will share with you that most lawyers I know don't even realize. So do not miss tomorrow's show. Joanne from Madison, what do you have to say this afternoon? Welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show.
This is all amazingly interesting, and I can't wait till tomorrow, but I've got a specific question. I always was thinking that the Supreme Court, because it covers so many corporate cases, and you know, even though these big social issues cases and all that seem to be so overwhelming and all of that, if you look at how many cases it deals with, you know, it's doing the work of the corporate masters. Okay, and that's why I thought it was being kind of left alone, because if it satisfies the corporate masters, that's enough for Congress, and Congress is also an arm of the corporations and doesn't serve us and the important issues that day-to-day people need to have solved. But am I really off base here? I'm not an attorney, obviously. I'm more in the corporate and the public policy realm.
Thanks for the call, Joanne. Really important question. So there's a couple of things buried in there. So even when we're talking about corporate cases, which generally have to do with federal regulations and the power of the administrative state, which is the regulatory state, to control what corporations are doing or tax them, or, you know, Obamacare requires certain medical coverage. That stuff, that administrative law stuff, that's a subject matter area of the court. What I'm talking about is a procedural artifact that now, while we're going to begin tomorrow with the death penalty, now is indeed reaching, Joanne, regulatory questions and the corporate issues. Again, the regulations that impact corporations. Now is where you see the court. Yes, the bulk of their actual decisions, the full written decisions, do have to do with regulatory law. There's just a ton of that. It's probably the vast majority of what the Supreme Court hears. But now it is this change that begins with the reinstitution of the federal death penalty in 1976 that eventually gets us to the place where all of a sudden regulatory matters have now become emergencies. One such example, mifepristone. You're not going to want to miss it. Come back tomorrow, everybody. If you were on the line today and I didn't get to you, call us back tomorrow. I'm going to put a bow on this one. You're not going to want to miss it. Thanks for listening, everybody. Stay safe out here. I'm Maggie Dawn. She's Anastasia Esther. And this has been a Tuesday edition of the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
I got my sights set on you.